Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hill at 246, four home runs, and 10 driven in. You like the red shoes or the blue shoes better?
Like that.
I like the blue shoes better. Way out of here.
Oh, my gosh.
Onto the roof. He hit it on the roof. He hit it onto the roof across the street. I have never seen that. On top of the building. Even he admired that shot. It's got to be the shoes, folks. It's got to be the shoes.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap. And Mike Donahue is with us to remember some crap. Mike, how are you doing?
Doing good, Andy.
Good. As always, the Pointless Exercise Podcast is brought to you by the good folks at Manscaped. Summer's coming. Are you ready to unveil your beach bod? You're in luck. Our friends at Manscaped just launched their fourth-generation performance package, which includes the Lawnmower 4.0. Complement your summer bod with a trim from the leaders in male grooming. The sun is shining and calling your name, fellas. Join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. And get ready for hot guy summer by going to manscaped.com for 20% off and free shipping with the code REMEMBER20. It's time to bundle up with the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0. Inside this package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer, the Weed Whacker ear and nose hair trimmer, the Crop Preserver ball deodorant, Crop Reviver toner, performance boxer briefs, and a travel bag to hold your goodies.
Andy, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to say the Crop Shaver is my personal favorite. I've yet to try the Weed Whacker, just waiting for those nose hairs to grow a little bit longer, but... Cheers to the Crop Shaver. Does the job, folks.
That's good. You know who could use the nose trimmer? That would be Clue Haywood. Because when he sneezes, it looks like a party favor. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code REMEMBER20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code REMEMBER20 at manscaped.com. They're on the interwebs. Escape the shrubs and weeds this summer and shine with Manscaped. And as always, it's time for us to spin the wheel of crap.
Yes, sir.
And find out exactly which fine season that we are going to be discussing. You had a mea culpa?
Yeah, mea culpa, one that I felt worthy of clarifying and correcting for the record. If you listened to last week's podcast and never listened again, I don't know what to say to you other than for everyone else, you may have heard me mention Ryan Sandberg. We did 1996 last podcast, and I had mentioned the autobiography that he had written with a local writer who I had identified as one-time Cub and White Sox beat writer Joseph A, aka Joey Reeves, and our longtime friend TJ Brown was quick to point out the obvious. It was a pretty serious flaw, because who else would write his name was listed as a co-author, but Sandberg's biography between his first retirement and his first comeback in 1994 and 1996 respectively. But of course, the Wizard of Oz, our very own Barry Rosner. Wizard of Roz. I said Oz, obviously. Schnoz. That was the
Schnoz. The Wizard of Schnoz.
And you know, so it was entertaining. It would make sense. Rosner would have been the perfect guy to do it. He was, you know, very close to Sandberg and whatnot, and say what you will. I just wanted to add, I just wanted to just go back. It wouldn't really fit a particular year because Joey Reeves was the beat writer on and off in the early 90s, but I got confused because he did write a book around the same time called For More Sort of Wrigley, and Reeves, interestingly enough, did not fit the profile of a standard sports writer. He was sort of a international war correspondent, and that's what the title would indicate. Probably kind of comes off, even in his own writing, as a little bit condescending, kind of a prick, and had, you know, no use
Wait
for
a minute. Alan Cubs writer that comes right. off as a prick?
Tribune writer, and Alan he spared no punches on Alan Solomon, who was his counterpart and with whom he would trade places. Because as you'll recall, in the early 90s, a period that which we have covered extensively on this show, Andy, and having done 91, 92, and 1994, the Tribune beat writers would swap the two teams in town. So Reeves did the Cubs and Sox, so would Solomon. He kind of scorched the earth. He was not really part of that fraternity. He was sort of recruited to Tribune by a name that might be familiar to some that will probably come up once or twice, Jim Dowdle, who you might recall was sort of like a successor to Stanton Cook, again, around the era that we spent a lot of time you know, dwelling on, the you know, early to mid 1990s of Tribune ownership, and Dowdle was the one that convinced Joey Reeves to take that beat over. Apparently Dowdle had the decision, and you
know. So now did Joey Reeves, I didn't catch the name of the other book that he wrote, did he write Rochelle from Milan to Minsk? No, I was on Seinfeld. I guess that's not. Now, I will admit that I knew that Rosner wrote that book, Second to None, Second Home, whatever the hell it is. And I just assumed when you were so confidently talking about Joey A. Reeves that he had also written a book on Sandberg. And I thought, well, maybe the Rosner book, which I think I read, was actually... I think I read. That's how good it was. I don't remember if I read it or not. I wondered if there was a book written before the retirement, and then they just cashed in and wrote a book after the retirement. That's why I didn't jump in to save your hot take there with Joey Reeves. All right, so let's spin the wheel of crap and see what year we land on.
You just can't get out of the
2000, the millennium.
We cannot escape. we gotta do them all anyway, right?
Yep. So the 2000 Cubs. What are your five things about the 2000 Cubs?
Happy to do it. Cubs open the season. Other end of the world in Japan.
Oh God, that's right.
With new leadoff hitter Eric Young, and they played a second game in 2000, and the game two starter, game one by the way being John Lieber, I believe. I think Carey was still hurt. It wasn't Carey. I don't think Carey made the trip to Japan. But game two, Kyle Farnsworth started game two. So those are the first two facts. First two games of the year. I will tell you, it was Don Baylor's first season. We were a little bit, you know, I think enthusiastic going in, but it got off to a bad start. They split in Japan, got swept by the Cardinals. The season wasn't quite over right away like it has been in some of the seasons we've done, like in 94, 97. I was in attendance for fact four when Cub great third baseman Shane Andrews hit a homer in the snow on opening day to tie a game that was, let's just get this over with, goddammit. Fact number five, Joliet Jeff Reed, local natives, game-winning walk-off hit in extra innings. The Braves, by the way, that was the last pennant they had won the year before. They were defending National League champions, and the Cubs took them and Kerry Leitenberg out on opening day. And that's the 2000 season. I've kind of stopped in April because there's just so much awesome stuff to really go beyond.
Yeah.
And look forward to the next, you know, hour, 90 minutes or so we can do just that. But those are five facts right off the bat.
Yeah, so the schedule was not all that kind to the Cubs. So they opened in Japan on the 29th and 30th of March, and then they opened in stateside on April 3rd in St. Louis.
Yep.
Doesn't it seem like you should either have – they should have sent the Cubs and Mets home as a reward or had them play somebody on the West Coast so they didn't have to hump it all the way or two-thirds of the way across the country?
And it was the Cardinals and every other team in the league that day or around those 2 days besides the Cubs and Mets. It was their first game of the season. So they were – right? I mean, for the Cubs, it was their third because they needed a few days off. You'll see a gap there. I could be wrong maybe. Perhaps the Cardinals played the series before while Cubs recuperated. But you're right. They basically touched down and then had to go down to St. Louis. And
I'm going to guess Cardinals, that it was – that was opening day. It was. That was opening. The Cardinals were 1-0 at the end of the game. So
there you go. I know it was opening day in St. Louis. It was also Jim Edmonds' first game as a Cub. So in some ways it was the is the Cardinal. Sorry, making, you know, malaprops in the first 10 minutes here. But yeah, first year as a Cardinal, it sort of signaled kind of an ugly era, really kind of taking foot down there in dog patch.
Yeah, the starter. The opening day starter for the Cardinals that year was Daryl Kyle.
Moment of silence.
Yeah, so they had an interesting start. They started off 1-0. John Lieber beat Mike Hampton, who had been freed from his term with the Rockies.
Was that after his contract with the Rockies?
I think so. I feel like that would have been about the time that he it was in between. He pitched for the Astros in 99, the Mets in 2000, then signed the big deal with the Rockies because of the school system. Wasn't the $180 million or whatever. It was the school systems. That's why he did it.
Sure, sure.
So he was traded heading into his free agent year.
Mike Hampton.
He was traded to the Mets with Operation Shutdown, Derek Bell, for Kyle Kessel, Roger Cedeno, and Octavio Dotel.
I see. I see. So he was the year before, the mid-season 99, Hampton was?
No, at the end of the 99 season. He pitched
okay.
He pitched all of 99. They apparently said, you know what, let's get something for him before he leaves as a free agent after 2000. And so we'll get Roger Cedeno and Octavio Dotel.
You know, I don't know if we've talked much. Mike Hampton's name has ever come up, and I'm looking at the stat line now, but we've done – I don't know if he came up in 97, but he sort of confirms my memory that in the late 90s he was a pretty standard presence, not in, you know, with a pretty tidy ERA. Who was his – Shane Reynolds? Was that the sort of show? What would they have going on down there in Houston? But Reynolds or Hampton was tough, and he was a hitting pitcher too. But yeah, he was coming off a 22-4 season, league leading. He finished second in the Cy Young, and then so Houston dumped him before the season started. Imagine that.
Yep. And he had a pretty good year with the Mets, 15-10 with a 3.14, and then two disastrous for him seasons with the Rockies. So he won 14 games his first year at a 5.4 win ERA, and then 7-15 with a 6.15, and then he got traded to the Marlins. Remember, the Marlins used to do this shit all the time where they would trade for a guy with no intention of keeping him. They were just going to flip him. And he came to the Marlins with none other than Juan Pierre from the Rockies. But then he got spun off to the Braves.
This is all in the offseason, obviously, because there's no stat line for Florida.
Right, he never played for the Marlins. It was in the offseason between 02 and 03. And then he was on the mighty 03 Braves that managed to lose the first playoff series to the Cubs.
That's right. Was he their game two?
85 years, was that right?
Would he have been the game two, the Russ Ortiz? No, right? That team didn't. They had Smoltz, but he was a reliever. They had Maddox in game three. Hampton may have been the game two start. May have beaten Zambrano.
He started two games.
Yeah, so it would have been game two, and I guess in game five. They beat him probably then.
Busy getting his ass kicked by Kerry Wood.
Yeah, I think that would have been it if you were to check that out. But, all right, so kind of confirms it. He was kind of a top pitcher. Obviously, the Mets that season – as it turns out, would go on to the World Series for the first time since 1986. But on opening day, at least, you know, we were a little excited, right? I mean, who didn't wake up, right? You got it. I can kind of remember where I was. If I thought about it, I was living on Hamilton in Chicago. I know I, you know, didn't go to work. But what would we have to do? Get up like 3 in the morning to watch opening day? Is that what we did?
I feel like the game started at 5, I think. I think they kind of started it late.
It ended around the time it was we had to go to work. I do remember that. I do remember the game. So maybe 2 game they walked on. They lost on a walk off grand slam to Benny Agbayani in game 2, and I think I remember listening to that. Arc. I could be a little bit of a mixed memory, but for the opener for sure. maybe I had to go to work then.
And a young Kosuke Fukudome was in attendance and tell everybody, I'm going to play for the Cubs one day. This was fun. Let's see. They started at 7:05 local time in Tokyo.
Okay. They're probably 15 hours ahead. I feel like it was a 4 or 5 o'clock start central time. I don't know my time zone difference from Tokyo, but...
All right. So 7 o'clock in Tokyo is 5 a.m. in Chicago.
So okay, 5 o'clock. That's what it was. Watch the Cubs. Then going to work a little bit late. I think I had. This was back when I worked for an independent company, and the owner was a diehard Cubs fan. We went to many games, so it was pretty much. I'm watching opening day like I do every year.
Right,
and the Cubs won.
Yeah, they won.
Sorry.
And got to think. Maybe perhaps it was some sort of. Maybe it was 4 because of like daylight savings time or something. I don't know.
It could be fiddle around that time. By the way, just to put a capstone on Mike Hampton, fun fact, losing pitcher in game 5. So really, Mike Hampton, as much as he had a lot of success over the Cubs, is the losing pitcher in the game in which the Cubs had clinched their first postseason series at that point in 95 years. So
that's 95. There you go. I gave him credit. I said it was only 85. I did the math wrong.
Wait, now, maybe it is 85. 08 to 03. Yeah, 95. It's, yeah, 95.
95. Now, that Cub lineup in Tokyo to start the season was a juggernaut. I don't know how. You got to give credit to Mike Hampton for keeping them to 12 hits.
I do know we had Eric Young at the top, right? In his first performance
Eric
as a
Young,
Cub.
They even updated the box score here to Eric Young Sr., just in case. One of my favorite Cubs, Sleeves. Damon Buford batted second and played center. Yep. Then you had Grayson first, Sammy in right, H-Rod, O. Henry was in left.
Still had O. Henry in 2000. Okay. I strictly think of 98 with him.
And here's where the lineup gets good. Shane Andrews at third.
Yep.
Jose Nieves at shortstop.
Good on number 11.
He was spelled late in the game by the great Jeff Houston.
Vaguely remember Houston playing with the Cubs.
Joe Girardi. Back
for the second time.
And then John Lieber. The other pitchers in the game for the Cubs included Brian Williams.
We've talked about him before.
Not Bison Daley, and not the guy who is hosts the disgraced former NBC Nightly News guy who now has his own show on MSNBC.
Yep.
And one of the great trades in Cub history, Rick Aguilera.
Oh, we'll save some of my venom for Aguilera for 1999. Because we've done the 2001 season previously, some of those names, Brian Williams was discussed during that season. And just to give it some perspective then, which I like to do often, we have not done 1999 or 1998, but we've done so many seasons within this period that I continuously call the mediocrity by design. It's this Tribune ownership that is really trying to maintain the status quo, maybe get lucky. This season, much like 94, 97, and even though we haven't discussed 99, was pretty much a dud. It did cost the general manager his job, even though he was, you know, had success in 98. Ed Lynch was gone. I want to just point out, too, when Ed Lynch got fired, this was sort of pre-internet-y. There was a feature in the Chicago Sun-Times that was written by Zay N. Smith, who I believe passed away recently. I could be wrong. If so, sorry for murdering you early, Zay. Not Zane Smith, the ugly left-hander for the Braves in the 80s, but Zay N. Smith. But he did some sort of like a sort of a fun features thing called QT and would take letters in and stuff. And mine got published because I, a 28-year-old Michael Donahue, around the time that Ed Lynch had gotten fired, had made the astute observation that at the point of Ed Lynch's firing that there are more Cubs on the 2000 roster at the moment Lynch got fired that the long departed Dallas Green had originally drafted as a member of the Cubs than Ed Lynch himself. And that, of course, the player was Joe Girardi, who wasn't continuously a Cub, but he was a Dallas Green draft choice who made his way back. 6 years into the Ed Lynch regime, the first part of the McPhail era, the third part of Tribune 2, Mediocrity by Design. 6 years into it, by midsummer, provided Kerry Wood was on his annual DL stint, there was nobody that he had drafted when he got fired after 6 years, and that there was Joe Girardi from 84 Cubs. So,
is that bad?
Just another disaster.
What notable accomplishment, the only time it ever happened to him in his career, happened to Joe Girardi in the year 2000.
He stood up before – oh, I'm sorry. That happened in 2002. Never mind.
Yes, I know what you were going to say. We'll get to that. We get to 2002. We'll
do 2002, which is an equally miserable season. There are still a lot of – as much of these we've had to pile through, there's still
I can tell a horribly inappropriate story about what I – watching the game on TV, what I thought happened. It's great. But say we're teasing that for 2002.
Yep. Tune in, folks. What did Joe Girardi do in 2000?
Yeah. I didn't know we ever did this. So that's just,
he couldn't have hit for the cycle because Mark Grace is still the last Cub to do that in 1993. I give up.
He was an all-star.
A good old Ron Coomer or Steve Swisher all-star, was he? Is that how bad the Cubs were? They had to send Joe?
Well, they didn't because Sammy started. So there were at least, I'm trying to look here.
Yeah, there were
just the two of them, it looks like. Ryan Dempster was an all-star that year.
For the Marlins.
God forbid.
How the hell did Girardi make it? So, you know, I think I know why. The Braves were defending champions, and hasn't Bobby Cox always been famously known for often carrying three catchers? Is that – maybe that's what it was? Even then, I can't imagine Joe Girardi ever being a top three catcher on merit. But good for Joe. I'll tell you, it was a down year. It was a down year for Sammy. He still put up prodigious numbers. He was still in that 5-year window where he hit like 300 homers in 5 seasons. Right. But it's probably his worst year from 98, through 01, I guess. But who really had a tough season, although I looked it up recently, the numbers didn't quite bear out entirely, but, Mark Grace, kind of the bloom was off the rose. He had a little bit of a death rattle season in the following year in Arizona. But I went to a game. Here's some remember some crap. And all I can tell you, it was a Sunday in April against the Marlins when the Cubs are getting off to a struggling start. And in the Sunday game, I don't know if it was Braden Looper or if I'm, you know, misremembering the era. But Grace had come up with less than 2 outs and a runner on third in the 9th inning of a tie game. And I remember we were sitting very close to home. I was like, it's Grace. All he's got to do is put the ball in play. And he struck out. And I just, you know, I know this is just anecdotal, but I just kind of had a feeling, right, at that point. I always enjoyed Grace. I think he's a little bit overrated by Cubs fans in general, but enjoyed him. Really good player, above average hitter, and first baseman. But sitting there that Sunday in a kind of a cool, overcast April and watching Grace not even put a ball in play, struck out swinging, which is not his thing, as we've discussed. Kind of, you know, a little punch in the gut. Felt like the end. So
Girardi's first half, when he was the All-Star, he hit 302, 374 on base, 415 slug. He had 4 homers, 21 RBIs, and 12 doubles.
Wow.
So I guess he made it on merit. The second half, not quite the same. 245, 288, 318, 3 doubles, 2 homers, and 19.
That reminds me of that 77 Cubs podcast that we did with Frank with Forklift. You know, how like the entire team just – that's Joe Girardi in 2000. Would that have been probably Girardi's only All-Star appearance, right? He was never.
Yeah, he never made one with the Yankees.
Well, that's how you phrased the question. Yeah. You know, this is peak Yankees too at this era. They're like, you know, you wonder they're winning with guys like Girardi and Scott Brosius. Like, I mean, they had great players, obviously. It's a weird time, and just it was really we're in a bit of a desert, right? By the time the year 2000 rolls around, since 1989, all we've had is a sort of fun but ephemeral 98 team. We would be a little bit rewarded with a fun season the next year, and then of course, you know, things really kind of maybe started to change. But 2000, I think all time morale was at a low.
So the 2000 Cubs, and they won the first game in Japan, then they lost, and then they had a weird stretch where 4 out of 5 games were walk-offs, one way or the other.
Okay.
Two walk-off losses in Cincinnati. Then they won the home opener as a walk-off against the Braves.
That's the game. That's the homer in the snow I was at. Andrews tied it off of Kerry Leitenberg in the ninth. Jeff Reed won it in the 11th or whatever.
And then they had a walk-off in the last game of that series. So they were 5-6 and had set the town on fire. And then they were 9-3.
Okay.
So
they swept the Braves, who were defending pennant. The Braves were sort of the Yankees of the NL. I mean, inferior, obviously. I don't remember actually even that sort of like brief optimism. I think basically it already gone into. It didn't go extra innings. They lost in the ninth, I guess, but they couldn't get a split out of them. And you know, you scroll down and you see more L's. What would they end up losing? I know it was over 90. Shit, they lost 97 games. So they statistically rank up there as one of the worst ever. And honestly, I have like this image in my head of tuning into a game in August, right? You know those games I'm talking about, Andy, where you know the season's over, you don't care, and you're just like in the house and you just turn a game on. It was like a Saturday afternoon in San Francisco, and just watching the sweated, bloated Ruben Quevedo just like struggling through an inning at the brand new Pac Bell Park. Just looking at the image, I know it happened in 2000. I don't know. I think Oscar Acosta may have been their pitching coach. I think he was. I think that's what I remember. So Acosta just fucking yelling at him on the Ruben Quevedo, folks. I wonder how many starts he got on that team.
So they went 17-9 in July.
What?
Yeah. And then rode that wave to 9-20 in August and 6-22 in September. But
wow.
Yeah, for 1 month they were relatively competent.
Do you remember having any strong opinion one way or the other when the Cubs hired Don Baylor?
No.
Because that's one thing I didn't mention about the context. I said it. All I talked about was that. Yeah, mostly I said the one playoff appearance in 11 years at this point, but they were coming off that '99 season, which was the other season besides 1997 when Jim Regelman had a stretch of 20-50, I believe, and they cratered. And Regelman finally lost his job after becoming the longest serving manager in our lifetime. And I remember wanting Baylor. I remember wanting him. It felt like they needed that culture. I know everyone kind of remembers this more in the context of Dusty. It was kind of similar. I was excited as what I remember, and I know this happened, and you probably can't verify it, but the Angels, the California Angels, I have no idea in hell who their manager was in 1999. Just that after that season, they would have traded Jim Edmonds for Adam Kennedy and whatnot, and maybe the previously mentioned Kent Bottenfield. But the Angels were in the running for Baylor and Mike Socha. And I just remember, oh, please, please, we can't let them get Baylor. Can't let them get Baylor. And we got Baylor, so it was a win for the Cubs, and the Angels had to settle for Socha, who, you know, I know they only won one World Series, but they went there, and he was largely successful for like 20 years. Cubs were like 5 managers in. Socha was still in L.A. But Baylor kind of like felt like he was like a no bullshit at the interview at the press conference. Like, you know, we're not going to use excuses, blah, blah, blah. None of this bullshit about like day games or whatever. And was disappointing about Baylor by the time he was gone. This was his first season. It was a dud of a season. And then he was decent, you know, the next year. Was it didn't take him long to pretty much sort of stand down from a lot of the proclamations he made about, you know, not making excuses. And by the time he was, you know, leaving town, it was like, you know, complaining about day games and, you know, just every little thing that, you know, again, Dusty kind of picked us up again and did the same thing. But I think we were largely optimistic. He was a big hire. Cubs went, they went in big on Baylor. He was a hot prospect. He had led the Rockies to their first ever playoff appearance in 95. And it was a get, believe it or not.
So the 99 Angels were managed by two men, one of whom won a pennant in 2015, and one of them won a World Series in 2016.
Terry Collins?
Yep.
And Joe Madden? No. Yep.
Terry Collins and Joe Madden were the two managers of the 1999 Anaheim Angels.
That's crazy. I knew Madden had...
Madden went 19-10. They probably should have kept him.
I knew he was affiliated with the Angels. So he was an interim. Collins got fired, and they brought in Madden, I assume, right?
Yeah,
Collins,
Joe managed the last 29 games of the season.
He went 19-10.
Yep.
And then didn't manage again till he took the Rays to the series in 08, so he didn't have to wait that long.
And, I mean, it certainly Angels, worked for the Angels. They hired Socia, and Joe was the bench coach, and they won a World Series. So
Joe hung around. Interesting. That's fun stuff.
Yeah, I was like, oh, who managed that? Oh, I've heard of that guy.
Well, they managed against each other for the pennant in 2015.
They did.
Coincidentally. See the things we discover when we...
It took Joe 7 years to get his first crack at it. The 06 Tampa Bay Devil Rays.
And he took him to the...
Not even the Rays yet. They were the Devil Rays.
They're still the Devil Rays. Christians be galled.
Well, we'll get to that's the only time we'll ever talk about Joe on this podcast because we don't go far enough to get to the.
That's right,
Joe Madden Cubs.
This is a distinctly non Theo Epstein era Cubs podcast. In case you've just stumbled in, kids, and don't know the conceit, it's a little bit of Wrigley, a little bit of Ricketts, a lot of Tribune.
So the Don Baylor Cubs carried on another tradition of that era where they were okay at home, 38-43, and a disaster on the road, 27-54.
Of course, the one team accepted, the mystifying 1994 Cubs, who were above 500 on the road. But yeah, well, I mean, you lose 97 everywhere, I guess.
They played the Cardinals 13 times. How many times do you think they beat them?
Can't believe they only played them 13. Did they beat them more than three times?
They did not. They were 3-10.
Oh, man.
Against the Cardinals. Yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the that must have been the – those were the balanced schedule days?
Yeah, 13 seems strange. Yeah, I never – you know, it is what it is. But when they went to the realignment and the wild card first in 94, 95, until that point, it was so easy to know what the schedule was every year. It was 18 games against teams in your own division, 9-9, and then games against the teams in the other division, which was just two road trips a year. And then, you know, it's all out of whack now, so don't ask me.
Yeah, so it looks like you played everybody in your division 13 times, and then you played the teams in the other National League divisions 9 times. And now it's 19-6, or 7 sometimes. So that's
okay.
They shifted some of those games over, and then they must have played more interleague games, too, it looks like.
They played more interleague games in 2000? Is that right? Like, from when they started? They started in the league in 97.
They played the White Sox 6 times.
Well, they had two, thanks to Uncle Jerry.
They played... No, it's the same. They played Detroit 3 times.
Kansas City.
I see Kansas City.
Yeah, 3 times. Okay, so I don't know.
Two or three. Oh, I see a name that will help me remember some crap from 2000. I know it happened. Shit, I might have the scorecard too, because I saw a name on there that I think we'd all like to take a minute to remember. His name, interestingly enough, did come up on a previous episode. I couldn't tell you which one. Scott Downs. You recall? I don't know. He ended up having he kind of had a little bit of a serviceable career, like several years after he left the Cubs. I don't know. But my Scott Downs memory is he didn't really do a whole lot for the Cubs. But I went to a game in 2000. I went with my buddy Chris. I was living down in the city. I was probably going about 25 games a year. Wasn't sitting in my seats. We just picked up tickets the day of the game. And as will happen at a ballpark like Wrigley Field, you might end up in a seat directly behind a fucking post. And I didn't feel like complaining. I didn't care. I went to a lot of games anyway. I don't know what we paid for the tickets. But the funny thing about my memory of this game, it was against the Tigers. It was a Friday interleague game against the Tigers. So, and Scott Downs, I think, threw a shutout. It was in the summer. It was June. It was almost around this time of year. But from my seat, the post was not right in front of me. It was a couple rows. So I could see, I could see most of the field. But what I couldn't see was the pitcher's mound.
That's all.
So I just sort of like, this is how I admired Scott Downs' performance that day. I just sat back and just stared at the post like it was a pitching machine and just waited for balls to fire out of them towards the batter. And after a while, he did not throw a shutout. He went 7 2/3. I found the scorecard. Seven hits, no earned runs. Starting pitcher for the Tigers that day, interestingly enough, Hideo Nomo. Too bad Harry Carey was gone, so he couldn't transpose that into Daryl Homo.
Yeah. I always thought that Harry avoiding Hideo Nomo saved his job. And Ron Santo never having to say Kike Hernandez also probably saved his job. So yeah. How many times do you think the Cubs traded Scott Downs?
Oh, he came back.
Yeah.
Totally forgot about that. Help me remember that crap. Did he come back on a useful team or no?
So he got traded. The Cubs, the 98 Cubs, you know, pumping for greatness, made a trade for a player to be named later and cash to the Twins to bring back Mike Morgan. And that player ended up being Scott Downs. But then the next year, needing a closer, they traded Kyle Loesch and Jason Ryan to the Twins for Rick Aguilera and Scott Downs. And then a year after that, at the trade deadline, they traded Downs to the Expos for Rondell White.
Rondell White. I knew that. I remember that.
Yep.
All right. So actually, that would have been the second. So in 2000, it was his second go-around with the Cubs, right?
Yes.
He didn't have a third, though.
Mm-mm.
But he did sort of.
Oh, who knows with the pitch lab? They may just bring him back. He pitched in 2015. He's only been gone for 6 years, so they may say, "Hey, Scott, you got anything left in you? You're left-handed. You can pitch till you're 50, and he's only 45. He's got 5 years left in him."
So wait, what was the 98? They traded him to 98
to get Mike Morgan.
Which, you know, we could write a book. It's not even on shitty pitchers, like great pitchers that come back to the Cubs, like Fergie, like Rick Rauschel, like Greg Maddux, like John Lieber. But then there's this whole tier of mid-range pitchers that were maybe borderline useful that still came back, and like Mike Morgan and Steve Traxel. Those are the only two, but I'm confident there are more. Just way too many pitchers to keep track of. I can't believe they brought Morgan back. But so yeah, I saw what was probably Scott Downs' finest performance as a Cub in 2000. I didn't, though. I can't say that. I was in the park for Scott Downs' finest performance as a Cub in 2000. I just didn't see him do it because I was watching balls shoot out from a bean.
So he didn't pitch well for the Expos, but then he landed on the Blue Jays and they turned him into a reliever. And he's like any reliever. He had good years and bad years, but he led the league in appearances in 07. He had a 2.17 ERA.
Wow.
He had a 1.78 ERA in 66 innings in 08. Even as late as 2013, he spent half the season with the Angels and had a 1.84 ERA in 43 games.
Wow.
So he turned out pretty good. And he pitched for the 2014 White Sox, and he was terrible. 38 games, 6.08 ERA.
Perfect. He pulled a Jaime Navarro. I love it.
So, that boy, Scott, that's what we like to see. If you go to the White Sox, suck.
Yes, then you'll be endeared, you know, even if perhaps you didn't do well or don't.
So one of my all-time favorite Cub pitchers pitched on the 2000 Cubs.
yeah, we already mentioned Ruben Cavedo.
Oh, it's this guy's even better. And I know you may not even remember him. Do you remember Daniel Garibay?
Vaguely. I remember him like throwing like it looked like a ball sock, just throwing it up like an ephus in the ball going 800 yards in an early season game. That's all.
27-year-old rookie left-handed reliever.
Out of the Mexican League or something?
Who Baylor decided that's the guy we need. And he was terrible. Yes, out of the Mexican League. Where I'm sure he was really good. He had pitched the year before for the Mexico City Tigers. He didn't even pitch well for the Mexico City Tigers. He was 2-5 with a 5.06 ERA. That was
Jim.
And the next year he was pitching for the Cubs.
And Jim Henry's on the phone. Oh, Nary!
I don't know I don't know where he pitched, because he didn't pitch. If he'd have been in like Japan or Korea, his numbers would be here. He pitched in 94 in the Texas League in San Antonio, and then not again until Mexico City in 99. He made another comeback in 2005 in the Mexican League, pitching for Angelopolis. And he had one appearance, and his ERA was infinity. So that
any other teams with any other appearances with any other major league team?
No, just the Cubs.
It's incredible. That's why, because I remember him vividly, even though I only can think of like one home run he gave up.
Yeah, I just remember thinking this is a bad sign that this guy made 5'8", 154 pounds. I knew it was a bad sign that he made the team, and it proved to be right.
And by the way, you did mention Shane Andrews, but you didn't mention the other piece of the brainchild, Ed Lynch's brainchild of the left right hand platoon at third base. That was to replace what he had when Gary Gaetti finally turned to dust and Cole Liniac just proved.
Oh, yes.
In his 2 months after being traded for Rod Beck that he was not going to be the answer.
Former Red Sox top prospect Cole Liniac.
Right. But this guy was
one of the guys that Peter Gammons would unintentionally tout,
like Matt Merton.
They would tell him, and then people are like, "Ooh, this guy's going to be good." It's like, well, no.
You mentioned that in connection with Matt Merton when we talked about the 2005 Cubs, that he was a little bit inflated thanks to Gammon. Yes. No, this player was actually Shane Andrews' platoon buddy at third, the solution, as it were. 3 years before Aramis Ramirez finally came to town to put an end to all this nonsense at the hot corner. Not a Red Sox prospect, but one time a Red prospect. But he was the left-handed side of that. You might not. I mean, he didn't really have much of a career, but he was touted briefly, I think.
Yeah, see, Liniac, I don't know when Gammons would have bragged about him. He hit 17 homers and 59 RBIs in Pawtucket in 98. That's not that great.
Well, and the Cubs traded Beck for him in 99 at the deadline.
And he played for the 99 Cubs, hit 241.
Well, terribly. I know. That's what I like. Remember the last 2 months of that season are seared in my brain.
Cole Liniac, Odell number 12.
But you haven't mentioned the Red prospect, Shane Andrews. What?
The Red prospect.
That was one-time Red prospect. Actually was their third baseman on opening day against the Cubs in 95, which I just recall. But you'd probably remember Wee Willie Green.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That was our answer at third base. Once we decided that Cole Liniac's 60-game tryout wasn't going to continue.
Willie Green, 201, 289, 365 for the 2000 Cubs.
What was Andrews? What did he finish at? I'm trying to pull it
229, up. 329, 474. So he was much better in every way.
More like the cold corner. Am I right?
Yep.
They had nothing on the horizon. They brought in Bill Miller after the season. I don't know. Maybe they were saved by Mark Bellhorn. Who knows? You know, it was just an extension of that period of time where third base was just a giant vortex of suck.
What, the Cubs didn't have anything in third? Like, that's not possible.
In 2000.
They tried all kinds of reunions. Dave Martinez came back.
He did. Was Dave Martinez, I think they got him for Brant Brown that year. They finally traded Brown.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Another Cub who came back when it was safe, I think. to do so. Wow, good for Dave playing. Another Dallas Green pick. Still playing for the – Tecumseh had two Dallas Green picks that played on the 2000 team. I know Kerry Wood. Oh, we got to talk about a Kerry Wood game. I have a pretty measured take on Kerry Wood, but I will not ever doubt some of the absolute highs that he brought. And we this is probably worth it to take a deep dive. I would refer you to like the first Tuesday in May against the Astros. And it happened to be opening night at Wrigley Field. And it was Kerry Wood's return after having won Rookie of the Year and blowing out his arm. Did he blow out the following spring? Is that how careless the Cubs were? Kerry Wood in 98, who I'm not blaming them for hurting them like I might more easily for Pryor, because Kerry Wood is used and abused going back to probably travel ball. Certainly was in high school. His arm was a time bomb. And the Cubs wrote him in 98, and he was up to the challenge until his arm blew out, and they just decided, let's give him a month and let him start in a long shot playoff game, in which he valiantly battled former Cub Greg Maddux and then wouldn't pitch again for the Cubs until this Tuesday or Wednesday in May. And it was in 2000. Kerry Wood missed the entire 1999 season. So as miserable as the 2000 season was, I will say there was this moment when Kerry Wood, on opening night, it was weird that opening night was in May, but the schedule just could, probably because they started off in Japan and then went on the road, that the Cubs didn't really have the opportunity to have an opening night until May, and it happened to be an unseasonably warm night. And I was in the ballpark, so I remember it. If you look up the details, I'm sure you'll find it. I don't know if you're looking at that game, yep, Andy.
I am.
And I can tell you a couple things, but I'll let you go through because I know what Kerry did, not just on the mound, but at the plate.
Well, there were three Cubs who hit home runs in that game, and I would say that Kerry was the least unlikely of the three. Kerry Wood, Willie Green, and Joe Girardi all homered off of Jose Lima. Kerry hit his in the second inning, a two-run shot. Willie hit a two-run shot in the fifth, and Girardi hit a two-run homer later in the fifth.
Kerry's was incredibly memorable. Did it? Maybe even given them the lead. But
it might have. It was part of a four-run second.
Yeah. No, it looks like it didn't. Willie Green, our guy, drove in a row with a double. Man, that was the Willie Green, Joe Girardi, Kerry Wood game, really.
Yeah.
Girardi and RBI ground out. So Wood's dong made it 4-love, but they're on their way. One of the things anecdotal, you could find out where he struck out Bagwell, but he struck out Bagwell on a 3-2 pitch with runners on early on where it mattered. And you probably know where I'm going with this, because Wood managed to do this a lot of times where he would just absolutely fucking freeze a hitter with his curveball. He did it all the time in 98, probably part of the reason his arm maybe blew off. I don't know. But I just remember Bagwell, who was in his prime, up in a big spot, Wood's first game. You know, it was very tense in the park, and he hung that curveball, and Bagwell was froze, struck out 10 in the inning,
yeah,
I believe.
It was the top of the fifth.
There you go.
Runners the second and third, two outs. He struck out Bagwell looking.
Beautiful, beautiful. There might be video of that. Who knows? I know we generally find some worthwhile footage of something online after we talk about it. It would be fun if there was evidence of Kerry Wood's comeback. It was, you know, again, we're in an oasis, man. We have had one sort of Cinderella-ish playoff team since 1989. We're trying to hang our head on something. Certainly Kerry Wood, who was front and center of that one playoff team as a rookie, was nothing but feel good around this time and that night.
Yeah, so Wood went six, only gave up three hits. He walked four, only struck out four, gave up a homer. But more incredible, Brian Williams got the save because he pitched the last three innings and lowered his ERA on the season to 10.29.
Wow. Well, a month in, you kind of need some more time. Got a save in an 11-1 game, right? I think that's the final that, yep, I just espied. Well, there you go.
What did he get?
Yeah.
Brian Williams got the ERA down to 9.62 at the end of the season. Way to go, Brian.
Yeah. And, you know, Wood had homered at least two times as a rookie, maybe even three. I know he homered off a Brett Tomko game I was at. He hit one against Philadelphia on a Saturday night, I think. So, you know, he was no Carlos Zambrano. But
no, who is?
You know, who is, really?
Well, Shohei.
Zambrano.
The only thing.
Just didn't play no outfield.
Well, that's true. He could have. He just didn't ask him to.
I don't know. I don't, you know. I love me some Carlos. But, yeah. So, yeah, I don't know how, you know, Wood had an interesting career, and that was a moment, and he was not worth on a team worth really losing too much or giving too much energy for.
Yeah, Kerry homered 7 times in the big leagues, and obviously because he turned into a full time reliever in 2007,
he would have probably been batting
basically.
Yeah. He would have had a dozen or so.
Yeah, that and the fact that he, even when he did start, he missed so many games.
Right.
He didn't get a lot of at-bats.
Well, and I think I brought it up before. Wood actually, in 2002, which is a miserable season for the Cubs, was sort of, I remember they were considering it a success. I might be a little bit off, but I'm pretty sure that 2002 was the first year that he went from opening day to the end of the season, you know, not missing a start. It was his 5th season, and I think he may have done it again in 2003, and that was it. Never did it again.
Yeah, he made 28 starts in 2001, 33 in 2002, and 32 in 2003, and then he makes 32 starts in 2003, and in 2004 and 2005 combined, he makes 32 starts.
Got it.
So that's not good. Because he did some relief. He was a part-time reliever in 2005. He only pitched in 4 games, all starts in 2006, and after that he was strictly a reliever.
Got it. Scrolling through, there was one other game that's kind of the flip of the Kerry Wood game. And because we remember this crap, I think we have to remember it. The Kerry Wood game, by the way, was, I think I said it was the first Tuesday in May. It was May 2nd. But the other game that, for all the wrong reasons, wasn't it? Do you remember an Expos game? I know it was in 2000. And I referenced it this year because there's a Cubs game that was almost headed towards this direction. It was a Sunday game in Montreal. Yep, I found it. May 14th. And the final score, the Cubs would lose this game 16-15. And I don't know if you remember this game. I remember it was kind of like almost like that Andre Dawson Pittsburgh game from 1991 where the Cubs just kept giving it back. You know, the Cubs basically, they had a 3-2 lead, a 6-2 lead. After 2.5, 6-4 lead, 7-4 lead after 3.5. Montreal scores 5, so now the Cubs are losing 9-7. They tie it in the 6th, 9-9. They score 2 in the 7th, 11-9. Or they have a 4, 11-9. The Expos score 4 in the bottom of the 8th to take a 2-run lead. The Cubs score 4 in the top of the 9th to take a 2-run lead, and the Expos walk it off, I believe, with Rondell White, future Cub, hitting just a single off of Rick Aguilera in the bottom of the 9th. Just one of those painful losses that, you know, just a shitty game for a shitty team. That kind of just a stupid game to lose. Interestingly, I see too that Hideki Irabu started against the Cubs.
So actually, Rondell tied the game. He had a 2-run shot in the bottom of the 9th. Mike Mordecai won the game with a base hit.
Who would hurt us in 2003, yes. Part of the whole events of the 8th inning. Yep. Yeah. I'm going to save my Rick Aguilera hatred for 1999, but let me just say that I accused Rick Aguilera of committing the same type of a crime that we sort of accused Fred McGriff of, as far as his willingness to, you know, jump behind the wheel of a possibly good team and do his part.
So
I'll leave it at that.
Lost in the tragic collapse of the blowing the lead. So here's Henry Rodriguez in the game. Henry was 4-for-6 with 7 RBIs. He hit 2 home runs. He had 10 total bases.
In his old ballpark, former Expo at this point.
Sammy was 5-for-6 with 5 RBIs. And I don't think he homered, which is rare for a big game. He had a double and 4 singles. Let's see. Willie Green had 2 hits. Eric Young was 4-for-5.
A guy.
But no, you get looked down at the pitching. And
wow.
The great Ismael Valdez, still spelling his name with a Z and not an S. 3 2/3, 7 hits, 9 earned runs. Todd Van Poppel did what Todd Van Poppel always did for the Cubs. 2 1/3. Hitless, scoreless innings. He didn't walk three, but he was pretty good for that.
I thought you were going to besmirch Todd Van Poppel.
I think the only team he was good for was the Cubs.
I think you confirmed that in a previous episode. Absolutely.
Then we got an inning out of Brian Williams, a third of an inning out of the run fairy, Felix Heredia.
Yeah.
2/3 from the Farns, and then Aguilera came in to polish it off.
I mentioned this on a podcast before. I'll just quickly mention it again. Opening day 2000, Shane Andrews' homer in the snow was the time a drinking since 10 a.m. Huey corralled the late Tim Weigel, who at that time was Channel 2 News. And Weigel recorded an interview with me where I just ranted about Matt Karchner and whatnot. And unfortunately, I guess the producers did not deem that worthy of putting it. Ended up on the cutting room floor. Yeah. I wonder why.
Do you think maybe they just pretended to record it? They just pointed the camera and never hit any buttons?
Weigel had a crowd, and as I walked by, I shouted something, and he turned around, and then he kind of grabbed. I don't remember what I said. Something about Karchner. I was, like, mad. They were losing. Who knows? Who cares? But, yeah, it was I thought it was going to be a moment of glory, but apparently I didn't make it on the 10 o'clock news.
Yeah, so the 2000 Cubs had Ty Van Poppel, who had a good year, 3.75 ERA in 51 games. As good as another year with the Cubs, but they also got an inexplicably good season out of Tim Worrell.
They did.
2.47 ERA.
They picked up Worrell off the strip. I will say, I feel like there was a time where the Cubs were sort of like vaguely but not legitimately alive. Was there a point was that they ever get – look at this. They got the lead down to like 9.5 games.
Oh, yeah. They were right in it.
There was a game they lost in San Diego, I remember. It's not like the Ryan Klesko, Jeff Fassero. That was a legitimate contender that season where I think like Phil Norton, who was terrible, got the start but managed to survive a Rocky Five, and they almost stole the game. It was like a day game in San Diego, that's it. That's all I'm going to lend to it. But Worrell was good, and actually they signed him off the scrap heap and then were able to flip him after the season for Bill Miller, who was actually, had he not shredded his knee in Busch Stadium, was about to be a useful everyday player for him. You mentioned Ismael Valdez, and I found a game that I was at, and I want to point this out because it was pointed out as being historically significant when it happened. Ismael Valdez, if you look at his game on June 17th, 2000, the Cubs won 1-0. Okay, it's another Expos game. It was a game at Wrigley Field. It was a Saturday afternoon. It's almost 21 years ago today. They won 1-0, and I don't know if you've bothered to pull this game up, Andy, and would be able to see who drove in the winning run in that game.
June 16th, is that what you said?
It was actually June 17th, 2000, Saturday afternoon. But look who the winning pitcher is, and then look who drove in the winning run.
The great Steve Rain.
Steve Rain won the game, but who drove in the winning run?
Oh, yeah, which there it is. Attended. Ismael Valdez drove in the only run of the game.
In case you wanted any further illustration as to how much paper mache Ismael Valdez was made out of, that he drove in the run, the only run in a 1-0 game, but was unable to stick around long enough because of blisters.
Yep. That's why the Dodgers got rid of him. They're like, he's good, but he can never pitch because he's always hurt.
Since somebody pointed out that it was the first time that since they had been recording these oddball arcane, involved stats or factoids since they've been doing that a pitcher had driven in a run in a game, the only run in a 1-0 game in which he didn't even win, a starting pitcher in which he didn't win. So thank you. It was the big free agent signing on the mound that year, I guess. Being in a second year and then having Wood. Sad that I can just name 3/5 of the rotation without even looking that team up, but three of those guys are actually on paper pretty good, but pitching, I think, was probably a big reason why that team stunk ass for most of the season.
Yeah, so the Cubs traded
Chad Ricketts, no relation, and Terry Adams.
Chad Ricketts, he's in the bleachers hitting on his wife. What are you?
To the Dodgers for Eric Young and Ismael Valdez.
I'm sorry, did you say Terry Adams?
Terry Adams.
Oh.
In 1999.
We discussed him around in some detail last week. Okay.
And then they were so excited about it that 7 months later, they traded Ismael back to the Dodgers for Jamie Arnold and Jorge Piedra.
There you go.
But yeah, it was all because of the blisters. The Dodgers were like, all right, somebody take this dude. And because he had won, he won 13 games in 95, 15 games in 96, 10 in 97, 11 in 98.
Yeah.
And he always had a good ERA. He never had an ERA over four.
He pitched the playoffs.
The Dodgers had, in 97, he had a 2.65 ERA and 30 starts. And they're like, ah.
Yeah.
Give him, yeah. And they just gave him to the Cubs. And then they got him right back.
Yeah. He only made 12 starts that year. The Cubs list six starters. I had forgotten that Kevin Tampa. Somehow I feel bad because he seemed like, you know, overall pretty good guy. But Kevin Tampany was pretty much a horse that year. Lieber had the most starts at 35, you know. And then Downs, Cavedo, Valdez kind of, you know, rounded out that rotation. And they still had the run fairy, as you say, Heredia. Hey, they got 3 years out of it.
Yeah,
Todd Noel, Kevin Ori.
Yeah, they got trade 3 years out of it. They forced 3 years upon us.
It was too bad that Ed Lynch was not around. So it was halfway through the season where Andy McPhail had to tighten up the tie that was nestled underneath his sweater vest and roll up those sleeves of his and do the GM job for about a year and a half. Yeah. Although I think they pretty quickly, even if unofficially, had installed Jim Hendry as the guy. It was Jim Hendry was still the scouting director, and even says that on 2000 base they don't even list Ed Lynch. They don't even give him the
I remember that happened in, why do I ever think that it happened in Atlanta?
Well, it happened on 7/29 or 7/19 apparently, yeah. July 19th.
But I seem to remember, and maybe I'm just pulling this out of my head, I seem to remember Andy having to come on the Cub broadcast.
You're totally right. You nailed it.
And he brought Hendry with him. And they basically announced that they were starting a transition that would end with Hendry becoming the GM, but that Andy would do it in the interim.
That's right. It was kind of bizarre.
It's one of those weird things. Why do I remember that they were in the broadcast booth in Atlanta? What does it matter?
Right.
But I remember that.
No, everyone's got a little inner Grabstein there. And you're right, because they played on Sunday, June 18th at home, lost to the Expos, had a day off on Monday, and flew to Atlanta that night. I'm sure that's when it happened. And so by the game time on Tuesday is when you would have heard, it must have been on Monday where they – or whatever, but they were in Atlanta facing the great Kevin Millwood that next night.
And they had to snuggle up with Chip and Steve. No, Chip and Joe?
Joe and Dave. Yeah. Again, it depends. If they were on cable, it was Dave Otto.
Oh, that's right.
If they were on Channel 9, it's cable for a lot of people either way, it was Joe Carter. This was the first of two seasons that Chip worked with Joe Carter and Dave Otto before Stoney came back from his mysterious.
Yeah. We know he did 01 because remember in that, folks, if you didn't listen to the 2001, remember this crap. You have to just for the clip of the crazy ending to the Rockies game when
you should listen to that episode anyway. I think this might be the best one we did just because there were some great things that just sort of
and we accurately predicted something because it had to happen.
It did. Yep. Yep.
So yeah, this is quite a roster of hitters in quotes. The Cubs had this would have been the year right when the Cubs occasionally trotted out the linebacker outfield of Henry Rodriguez, Sammy Sosa, and Glenn Allen Hill.
Yeah, and by 2000, I just want to say that Sosa was in the midst of a 300 homer streak in five seasons, which is incredible juice or no juice. But he was also in the middle of a transformation into becoming an absolutely one dimensional ball player, and his defense was becoming pretty much a full afterthought by now.
He was getting big somehow. I don't know. He was just seemed to be getting bigger and bigger, almost like he was on something. But I don't know.
Right. I put it in the chat. If you ever have time, the May 2nd, 2000 Kerry Wood game is in its entirety on YouTube.
Oh, well, I should put that on.
We may have to schedule another episode, do a deep dive, depending on how many stupid things Chip Carey uttered, ruining the moment, I'm sure, I guess. I don't have, you know, I was there, so I wouldn't have remembered if Chip ruined it anyway, but yeah, something to, you'd have to fiddle with it, because it's 2 hours and 17 minutes. But, you know, if you're working alongside Baseball Reference and can see the home run and the strikeout of Bagwell, those are really the two highlights. So,
now for the longest time, like when we were, not even when we were growing up, we were grown up and this was still a thing. Everybody was going on and on about how the Cubs hadn't had a good third baseman and whatever.
Just Madlock. Or they said Sano, but it's really Madlock, right, who came after Sano.
When really, because of Santo and Madlock and then Aramis, and then some guy named Chris Bryant,
right,
doesn't even play there anymore.
It's a different narrative now, isn't it?
The biggest hole in this franchise that goes back even farther is center field.
Yep, because I mean, at least Dexter, the 69 Dexter Cubs Fowler's, had Santo.
Dexter Fowler's two seasons like stand out like a sore thumb because it's actual like beyond mere competence. And really, he had three good halves for the Cubs because he really struggled his first half. He had a big home run in Colorado in the first half of his first season.
Then he slumped, but then he came out when it counted.
And then so he was good at the end of 2015, and he was good in all of 2016. But so the 2000 Cubs had three of their greatest hopes at center field stardom, on one team.
Two of them were from the Ed Lynch, Andy McPhail school of signing guys whose fathers you remember having played as major league ball players. Damon Sleeves Buford and Gary Matthews Jr.
Right. So Damon Buford, son of former Met Don Buford.
An Oriole.
And then Gary Matthews Jr., son of former Cub and Philly and Giant.
84 Cubs, Sarge.
Gary Matthews Sr. And Corey Patterson and Dave Martinez.
Wow, veritable.
I mean, who's who? I don't think I can't imagine they tried to make poor Dave go out and play center field when he's 35 years old. He was probably playing first base, but
he was a pinch hitter. Yep. And I will say Gary Matthews, his teammate and trade partner, a guy that he came along with on the eve of the 84 season, Bob Dernier, had a couple of decent seasons, but other than Dexter's two seasons, Dernier's two seasons, Jerome Walton's rookie of the year season. You're absolutely right. Even the 69 Cubs at least had Santo. One of the big autopsies is that one of their problems is they didn't have a center fielder. Young was not the answer.
So they haven't had anybody good in center field for more than two seasons since.
Maybe Andy Pafko, I think, if he played center. I might not even know if he did. I think he did, but.
Didn't Hack Wilson used to go out and play center even though he was 5'9", 230 pounds?
And drunk.
I'm sure he was a real defensive whiz.
Well, you're right. He's most famously known defensively for losing a ball in the sun in the 29 series, which led to the very eerily similar to the events of the eighth inning in Game 7 in 2003, but led to a huge Oakland comeback where they went on to take the series.
So. Yeah, so Hack is probably – he's their best center fielder ever. He played – 1, 2, 3, 4. He played five full seasons in center for the Cubs.
You know what that's analogous to, Andy? It's analogous to Chicago Bears wide receiver history. That's our greatest center field, all around center fielder. That's our. He's closer in era to Johnny Morris Johnny Morris is closer in era to Hack Wilson than he is to today as a player. So
Hack led the National League in home runs four of those five seasons.
Uh-huh.
And led the National League at least in RBIs in 1929, and we know all of baseball in 1930 because he still has the record of 191, thanks to Jerome Holtzman.
Jerome Holtzman, yep.
Went and found Hack another RBI.
Don't know how he did it, but he did.
But, yeah, that's so the Cubs' last good center fielder of any amount of time.
He
stopped playing center field for them in 1931.
Wow.
90 years ago.
Yeah, I'm going to take a deep dive. I'm wondering, I guess even if Andy Pafko was a center fielder, they traded him away to LA to the Brooklyn pretty early in his career, so it's kind of rendered moot. And I don't know what else you'd have. I don't really know my center fielders of the 50s other than the Cubs suck.
No, don't you think if
Baumholtz?
If we had somebody good, we would remember.
Yes, right. Even if it's before our era, right.
Well, yeah, Pasco played.
Did he play center? Does Baseball Reference, are they able to delineate?
Yeah, he played center through 1947, so 43 to 47. He was an all-star in 47. Then they moved him to third base because they're like, hey, let's plug our other hole.
Was it bomb holes?
Right. And then in 49 and 50, he split time between right, center, and third.
Okay.
And then in 51, he played center and got traded to Brooklyn during the season.
Oh, he played with the Cubs a lot longer. So, but it didn't sound like he was really the natural center fielder. So he might have.
Okay, so say it's Pafco. That means they haven't had.
It's still 70 years.
Yeah, it's been 70 years since they had a center.
Like, and all we're asking for, the baseline, right? I think we can set it at three. Three above average seasons in a row. And nobody's going to hit that. Dernier and Dexter might come closest. In our lifetime, I think that's safe to say.
You don't think Ian Happ is going to.
Yeah, I like Ian. I don't want to go down that road. He's not that good of a center fielder, but if he plays every day for a few years, I guess he's going to be in the discussion because I know he gets hot and cold, but he generally puts up numbers. So I don't know. We'll see. But I don't think of him as much of a center fielder either. But
no, I should just re-sign Chris Bryant and let him play center field.
Bryant, yeah, he'd be more likely to win a gold glove in the outfield than at third base, maybe. Yeah, put Bryant in center and third so he'll help fill both, you know.
He's already kind of.
You know, it's funny. You're right about that. I mean, think about it. Now, you just go back now 20 years. We've been sort of, filthy. You know, Ramirez was the most productive hitter for almost a decade.
Third base has not been a problem now for a long time.
No, it really isn't.
For 18 years.
But you're right also, it was never as bad as center field, yet it always kind of grabbed the narrative. I wonder why, looks up at the radio booth.
Yeah, I can't imagine why there was a emphasis on one position and how them not having a perennial all-star in that spot somehow meant that the guy they used to have there was a Hall of Famer by default.
I will say that he did probably deserve to be in the Hall of Fame.
He absolutely did. It was that was part of what made the it's what made the argument endure. It's also what made it annoying.
Yeah.
Because it's like, yes, of course he should be in. He was for the longest time the best player not in the Hall of Fame. The best eligible player who was not in the Hall of Fame for maybe longer than anybody else was Ron Santo. And then they waited till he was dead before they put him in.
So, unless possibly Hack Wilson was longer because he was a guy that Mike Royko wrote a lot of articles about till he got veterans in the late 70s. But yeah.
And that was, then, of course, Harold Baines.
Oh, God. it's the most damaging thing that will ever happen to the Hall. You can now that the Harold Baines floor.
You got to give the White Sox credit, though. They shifted the narrative of – they got tired of everybody saying that Nellie Fox was the worst player in the Hall of Fame.
Yep. You won't get an argument out of my dad on that one.
So they just shoved in another former White Sox instead to take up the new argument.
It's so embarrassing because, like, as for as much as we look like fools for rooting these idiots on, we get the benefit of just you and I having to like see the entire arc of Ryan Sandberg's career and Andre Dawson and Kerry Wood and Sammy Sosa and Mark Grace. Only a couple of those are Hall of Famers, but it's just like embarrassing that that Harold Baines is so deified. Like immediately, he was a really good player, but it's just so much like just false nostalgia that propels that. I mean, they retired his number when he was still playing after he got traded, right, for Sosa. Then he comes back. He played forever.
Yeah.
I just, I laugh. I don't really.
In a way, I mean, obviously he's a Hall of Famer. He gets all the shit that goes with it. His autographs worth more and all that stuff.
He's not a deserved Hall of Famer.
No, but it actually puts – that's he instead of being remembered as a really good – player, he's now remembered as a guy who's in the Hall of Fame who shouldn't be.
Worst Hall of Famer.
So Jerry didn't do him any fucking favors, really.
Well,
he's made him a punchline. It's like, oh, fucking Harold Baines.
It is.
They erected the Harold Baines statue in 1996 or whatever, and they were still hitting fly balls at it.
It would be like us doing all this shit for Grace, which I know some fans might be in a hurry to do that. Like, hey, put a statue, which I – no. But – it would be like that, and that's embarrassing.
If I'm handing out statues for Cubs, the first thing I'm doing is I'm redoing the Harry Carey one because I just find that
I know, so creepy. You wrote about that this week, but I've observed that since they first threw that up. It looks like this sort of.
I remember
like,
the first time I went and looked at it, I'm like, what is this?
It's this boiling sea of like screaming voices.
It's people trying to drag Harry to hell. That's what the whole thing is. The fans are trying to drag him to hell. Because the other statues are so good. Like, they really have, like, the Billy, the Ron Santo statue might be the best.
Really?
Like, that's just a really well-done statue. And the Billy Williams one is cool. Billy looks very 70s in that. That's really cool. They do a really nice job, except the first one they did, it's just not a very good statue.
Yeah. I haven't ranked the statues, but just off the top of my head, the Harry one, just from that whole, like, sea of tortured souls from which he's emanating. Little off.
Then I can't wait to go down and help them move the bear statues up to Arlington. That's going to be fun.
Bring it on, man.
Put those in a truck.
5 miles away.
And Vag and I will drive them right up.
Cruising down Euclid Avenue. Yep.
Are we going to the mall? Yeah, we're going to the mall. Yeah. We're going to stop a little short. It's going to be fine. Don't worry about it.
Right.
Okay, so 2000 Cubs, do you remember Raul Gonzalez?
Nope.
No, me neither. Do you remember Osvaldo Morena?
Not in the least.
No, he pitched twice for them.
Okay.
See, Will Omen, was one of Will's stints. He only pitched in six games.
And I want to mention that because you sort of had introduced this point, which I've really sort of embraced, how the peak Atlanta Braves system managed to produce all this great pitching while at the same time passing off all their shit as overvalued excess of that system when in fact they were just shit. And the Cubs were probably the first in line almost every time they were selling. And Will Omen is one of the personifications of that practice. Absolute bomb.
Oh, there's Joey Nation. That's another one.
Joey Nation.
He was on the 2000 Cubs.
Micah Bowie, which was later. I think one name that maybe not. No, I think Bowie. They were on the Jose Hernandez trade from 99. And Quevedo, I think, right? I think if I know this fucking trade, then that's sick. But I think the Braves gave us Quevedo, who was terrible. They gave us Nation. They gave us Bowie and whoever that fourth one was. But another one a few years later for Juan Cruz, we got Andy Pratt, who I think never threw a strike.
Oh, yeah. He was fun. Yeah, so August 24th, 1999, the Braves send Joey Nation to the Cubs to complete a trade deadline trade. That trade was the player named later, which became Nation, Micah Bowie and Ruben Quevedo for Jose Hernandez and Terry Mulholland.
But not Will Omen, or Will Omen was the third guy in that trade?
No, Will was not in that deal.
Separate trade, but he came from the Braves too. Yeah, so the Braves. That it wasn't one trade. It was like every time the Braves were calling, Lynch and McPhail were ready to.
What do you guys
scoop
got?
Up those sloppy seconds.
What do you got for us from your great?
Well, I got.
You guys got a thing called a pitch lab? No, we don't.
Quite a dichotomy.
All right, no. So Will Omen, a homegrown Cub, drafted in the eighth round of the '98 draft.
Oh. My apologies.
He had quite a career. Released in 2003.
Wait, what year, 98 you said?
Yes. Released in October of 2003 by the Cubs. Re-signed in February of 2004. Cubs like, oh, no, that was a terrible mistake. We got to get Will back. Traded with, do you remember the great Omar Infante? The Cubs got him from the Tigers and he never played for them.
But that's like an Epstein era guy, right? Kind of, sort of. Yeah.
So the Cubs traded Omar and Will to the Braves in 2007. For Jose Ascanio, the ass can.
I remember the ass can. I think Apex, our good friend Andrew Peck, coined that one. We had high hopes for the ass can. Should have known by then the trend that Braves pitchers, whether they be starters or relievers.
So actually the Cubs, they turned the tables on the Braves. They gave them Will Omen. Like, here you go. Enjoy this shit. He lived only to make Lou Piniella's head explode.
And Oscar Acosta.
We got a guy out there throwing 55-foot curveballs.
That's right. So that was Will Omen 2.0, right? Or was Will Omen consecutively or successively with the Cubs from 2000 to 07? He came back. They shipped him to Atlanta and back? Or did he? Did that cockroach manage to stay in their system for parts of 8 seasons? I can't. He was a glib MF-er. I will say that. Like, he knew he was a moth to lights. He was a guy that, without having done anything,
you would see
his quotes.
Well, he missed his two stints. He never left, but he got hurt and missed all of 02 and 03. And then all of a sudden he was back in 05.
Okay.
And pitched in 06 and 07. That's when Lou tried to kill him.
Yep.
And then he went to the Braves, the Dodgers, the Orioles, the Marlins, and he finished up with two great seasons for the White Sox.
Another one? Did he suck? Please tell me he at least sucked.
Oh, yeah,
for them.
6.41 ERA in his last year with the Sox.
Was that the same guy we already mentioned earlier then that finished with the Sox, or was that somebody else? Can't remember now. I think it was Omen, so.
No. That was that wasn't him. That was somebody else. That was Scott Downs.
Oh, that's right. I'll always have a place in my heart. Even if they didn't do well with the Cubs, if they sucked for the Sox, they'll have a place in my heart. Or the Cardinals, for that matter.
But yeah, so the 2000 Cubs, one of the worst teams in Cubs history, 65-97. And then inexplicably, in 01, they almost made the playoffs.
Right.
And then in 02, terrible again.
Yeah. Yeah, we were sort of in that cycle perpetually now, and it's been sort of cast for 10 years, right? I talk about when Tribune really sort of, after that Jim Fry debacle, no more spending, we're going to cut to the middle. This is now 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's like their ninth season. They were terrible. I mean, they didn't try to be good. They were good in spite of themselves. They made the wild card 2 years earlier. They made a run for it in 01. Things altered a little bit in 03 and 04, the trajectory changed, but they were pretty much in the thick of this designed mediocrity. It was really not really, I mean, yeah, they brought in Ismael Valdez. Yeah, that was your big free agent signing. Eric Young, he was a good leadoff hitter. I mentioned this before. Eric Young had a really good season for this team without even looking it up. I can tell you he did. And when that Cubs team, to which you alluded, the next season was surprisingly in contention, that was in spite of Young, who happened to have a poor season the next year.
Yeah, so bringing back Joe Girardi and getting Eric Young were both at the behest.
And Ricky Gutierrez.
And were at the behest of Don Baylor, who had managed Eric and Joe with the Rockies. And he wanted
that. That's right.
And they went out
That's
and got
right. Them. Okay.
And I honestly did not remember that Joe spent 3 years with the Cubs in the second stint.
Well, I know he was on the 02 Cubs, but we'll talk about why when we talk about the 02 Cubs.
That's why when I saw him, I'm like, he was there in 2000? Because I really thought he was only there in 01 and 02.
Daryl Kyle pitched the opening day. That still could have been 2000. It was the middle of summer and that happened.
The 2000 Cubs, that's the midst of a pretty rough stretch.
Really is.
Other than some mild competence in 95.
Yep. And then 98.
And then the 98, just the fluke, which we knew was a fluke at the time. I mean,
I think so.
That's
it
about
was still
as
fun.
I mean, because there's
nothing.
At 2000, I'm sure we were rooting for a strike. Because 94, 49, and 64 with the strike. 96, 76, right. And 86, 97, 68, and 94, 99, 67, and 95, and 2000, 67, and 97.
This was worse than 99 and 97. They lost the first 14 games and only lost 94 that season.
So we were hanging a lot on one fluke year in 98.
Yeah, in ways in which I hadn't even really considered, it really was a ridiculous patch because we'd had a taste of it. So it's one thing to have 4 decades of nothing going into 84, but then 84 is followed up 5 years later by 89. So, you know, you can get a little spoiled even though it's barely a taste. And then you go 9 years, you kind of get back there again. And so by the time this team rolls around, it's kind of like all those good memories and positivity were kind of getting extinguished. You know, we know it didn't stay that way, but they were definitely mired in this sort of consistent, just bad. None of those teams lost 100 games, but holy shit, many of them lost more than 90.
Yeah.
You know, if you lose 90 games, you're really not – you're not in it. We're used to that. It's pretty much the whole decade. And by decade, I mean the 2000 to cap off the 90s. Because, you know, things did change a little bit, I guess, after the season.
Yeah, because really what you look at this baseball reference thing that shows year by year, and they have top player listed by whoever had the highest war. And so this terrible stretch of Cubdom, we had Sammy and nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. We had Kerry Wood occasionally.
Yeah.
And but the only guy that was always, you know, there for this whole run, because Grace would be
Grace
gone
was on the decline and then gone.
Yeah. Is Sosa. I mean, it goes from 94 to 2002.
Yep.
Every year, Sosa's has the highest war on the team, except for 97 when it's Grace.
Wow. Sammy had a tough year in 97. Okay.
It's Sosa, 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 Grace, Sosa, 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 Sosa. And so,
yeah.
I don't know what year we get into this. I don't think it has to happen now, especially not at the end of this podcast. But the weird shunning of Sammy by the Ricketts, who act like he did something personally to them when he wasn't around when they owned this team. And they've made it into a much bigger deal than it needs to be. If all they had done was put Sammy in the rotation where they invite him back to the convention once every 3 or 4 years, and then once every few years they have him come throw out a first pitch, nobody ever makes a big deal out of it. Nobody cares. Well, and then they wouldn't even say why they wouldn't bring him back.
And the funny thing is that they would never really even be the victims of any of sort of like an unpredictable outburst by him. Like if he were to go off, it might have been on the previous. He had no issue with them. He wasn't going to like embarrass them. So I don't know what the risk was. You know, I don't know what they were protecting.
They've always acted like, for whatever reason, that there's no in between. Either they give him a phony baloney ambassador job and put up a statue, or they don't acknowledge his existence. There's plenty of room in between those two things.
McGuire managed to navigate it, and he did not have the Q factor that Sammy does. I mean, Sammy's was very much pretentious and manufactured, but he was certainly to young kids. The guy was extremely likable.
Well, and Sammy had a much longer run with the Cubs than McGuire had.
That's right.
With the Cardinals.
Well, he's like, you know, I mean,
they've just made it weird, and we know over time that's what they do. They create crises for themselves because they're
– Yeah, it's interesting. In spite of falling ass backwards into Theo Epstein and winning World Series, there are some parallels between how it's run and how they're run in a lot of these years that we're covering in the 90s. You know, you got a little bit of a cash cow in the ballpark. You've got, you know, some defined revenue every year, keeping some of your marquee stars, which I'm not even sure they're doing now, but we'll see how it plays out. And maybe that's a little unfair. The team now is better. What we're seeing now, obviously, is light years away. I mean, I'm not drawing a comparison. I don't want to be an ingrate. We're experiencing. We're still, for all the disappointment and, you know, changed expectations, we're in a period now in the last 6-7 years that we hope to be in at some point and is clearly different, which is why we don't even go into it, because it's still evolving. But just from a management perspective, it's, you know, it's fair to draw the comparison between how they operate sometimes and how they did in the 90s.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the first, and I won't be the last person to point out how, like, just completely unlikely, unbelievable it would have been to have said, all right, somebody's going to come in and buy this team, and they're going to win a World Series, and they're going to erase all that crap. And within 3 years afterwards, everybody's going to hate them. Nobody would have believed that. They bought themselves a decade's worth of goodwill, and they pissed it away in 3 years.
Yeah.
So, but that's
fine. Yeah. Well, they got that World Series, which from the vantage point of 2000 or the 2000 Cubs, obviously we would have killed for.
Yeah, I mean, there were years, many years, where it just, you were resigned to the fact that they were never going to be able to figure it out, ever. That it was like they were playing a different sport than every other team.
Like rearranging the deck deck chairs in the Titanic, like getting rid of Lynch, like such a non-move. Even above McPhail, like Tribune getting rid of Himes and bringing in McPhail, you know, the modus operandi was remained the same. It was not, you know, not to be anything daring or innovative. But those guys would get fired if you had too many bad seasons. You're going to be gone. Larry Himes in 94, Ed Lynch in 2000. You know, they kept up appearances, but they were not interested in really winning. They wanted that ballpark full and have guys like Sammy, right, to market around. That's kind of the, you know, the McDonough angle. But yeah, we were in it and probably not even aware of it, the depths that we were in at the time. It's a lot more obvious now.
Well, I mean, there was a definite, I know I felt this way, where there were times you were like, just, I have much better things I could do with my time than this. Why am I watching this? But there was always that fear, because they would come out of nowhere with these inexplicably good seasons.
Yep.
That you were going to give up just at the time they were going to back-ass their way into a World Series. And you were going to be like, oh, I should have been watching this the whole time.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't have that luxury anymore. If they go on another, if they go on a prolonged run of not being good, there's a whole generation of Cub fans who are like, no, I saw him win a World Series. I got other shit to do. Sorry.
That's right. That's right. The whole perspective will become more pronounced. The difference in perspective will become more pronounced as time goes on. You know, you think of the franchises now that, you know, are in that boat. It's not us. We're one of the more recent ones. Right? Be a Mariners fan or, you know, Indians, obviously. That's their problem.
Yep. We don't have to worry about that. We carried that mantle longer than anybody else ever.
No, and I think anyone that's listened to this through its entirety, the anguish and the absolute horrific mediocrity of the 2000 Cubs and how emblematic it was of so many teams, especially before it, you know, a little bit after, things did change. But for the most part, it was kind of the end of a pretty impressive run of just crap, I guess. 2000 Cubs.
All right. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Andy.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Many of us have herpes,